brings us to the final chapter of the term, which is the chromosomal basis of inheritance. That's the name of the chapter. And what's different about this chapter compared to what we've been talking about in others is that we're focusing on things at the chromosome level. So we can see this in slide one right away. There's really nothing new about this cross. This is exactly the same dihybrid cross I showed you in the previous chapter with seed color and seed shape. But notice that we have drawings of cells here with chromosomes in them to show you what's happening at the chromosome level. You know, we've been talking about things that happen to genes, but keep in mind, think back to meiosis. Genes don't operate in isolation. They're not free to do whatever they want, right? Genes are just subsequences within the overall long sequence that makes up the chromosome. So genes have to go wherever the chromosome goes. They're passengers on a ship, so to speak. And that's why they're drawn here, the chromosomes. And the little black marks just represent the locus or the location for that particular gene of interest. Okay, so notice that there are four chromosomes shown in each of the two parent cells. Now, what is the ploidy?
Diploid.
It is diploid. What is N? It's a trick question. We have no idea what N is because we're ignoring any chromosome that doesn't carry either of the two genes that we care about. It's a dihybrid cross. We don't care about any other gene other than those two. Okay? So it's at least two, yes, but it's more than two. I just don't know the number for pea plants. Anyway, that's why only two are shown. And notice that these two genes that we care about, color and texture gene or shape gene, they have their loci on different chromosomes. That doesn't have to be true, but it is true in this case. When two different genes reside on two different chromosomes, then they are said to be unlinked genes. Okay, and that's what's true here. So, everything that we've already been talking about is happening here. You just see what's happening at the chromosome level. Meiosis, which is gamete formation for a diploid, randomly chooses one chromosome or the other, right? But it doesn't matter which one you choose originally because these are true breeding parents. That's why there's one possible gamete for each of them. And therefore, only one possible offspring, a double heterozygous individual, that each of those has one uppercase R carrying chromosome and one lowercase R carrying chromosome, similarly for the Ys. Okay, no new information. Then we get to this point where there are two boxes. And these are two Mendelian laws, two things that Mendel came up with, called the law of segregation, as you see, and the law of independent assortment. Well, we already discovered what's happening in reality, which Mendel never did know why this was, what was actually happening molecularly, but he figured out this is happening. But we already have studied this. The law of segregation, as you see, says that the two alleles for whatever gene separate during gamete formation. In other words, a diploid individual produces haploid gametes because the two alleles, each on two different chromosomes, separate from each other and go into separate cells. That's the law of segregation. And when does that happen specifically? What specific part of the cell cycle is described by the law of segregation? More specific. No. Cytokinesis is necessary to make it actually officially two different cells. But when does the segregation of chromosomes occur specifically?
Once
S, anaphase 1, not just anaphase. There's two anaphases, right? Anaphase 1 is when law of segregation happens, or when segregation happens. And that's why, remember, the ploidy goes from diploid to haploid. Because you're going from a cell that has two of each type to two cells that have one of each type. Okay? The homologs, we don't even use the word homolog after that point, because the homologs are now in separate cells. The other Mendelian law here is independent assortment that we've already talked about. When does that, what is that part of the cell cycle that it's referring to? We've talked about independent assortment before, including today. Just in the previous chapter. But when does it occur? No. Doubly no. Not anaphase and not two. What did we just say assortment refers to?
I said metaphase.
Oh, you said metaphase?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, then you're half right. So only one no. Independent assortment occurs at metaphase one. Right? That's the only time you have a tetrad. Assortment refers to how a tetrad lines up, because there's two possibilities. When you have sister chromatids and just one replicated chromosome lining up, it doesn't matter, right, which way it lines up. But when you have a tetrad made of two non-identical chromosomes, it does matter how you line up. That's why it's referring only to metaphase one. Okay, but otherwise, everything, I mean, this whole thing is all stuff we've already learned. It's just introducing these two laws and showing you what's happening at the chromosome level. Now, the second slide, not much information on here, just shows you a couple pictures, close-up photographs of fruit fly eyes. So the fruit fly bodies are cartoons, but these are real photographs of eyes. And these fruit flies are in a genus called Drosophila, which, notice that I italicized that. Drosophila is a genus that's used in a lot of genetic studies because it's a good model organism for genetics. For multiple reasons, one of which is that these fruit flies are very easy to keep. They don't die very easily in laboratory conditions. You just have to give them some basic food and they'll live and mate, produce offspring. Another really important reason is that it only takes about a week for a lifespan. So in a lot of genetics experiments, you want to go through multiple generations, right, to get various kinds of results. Well, that's, you wouldn't want to use humans for that, right? You'd have to wait 16 years or more for a generation, even if you were allowed to use humans. But you only have to wait a week for fruit flies. So they're used for all kinds of studies. Here, though, we're looking at a specific characteristic, eye color, that is a little bit controlled genetically differently from anything we've talked about before. You have red eye possible and white eye possible, as you see here. The red eye is an example of the wild type, which you've seen that phrase before. But let me just repeat what wild type means. Wild type refers to the kind or the phenotype that is most often encountered in a natural population. And so fruit flies, which you can... If you don't happen to have any in your house, all you need to do is leave a banana peel in your house for a couple hours and you'll have some. But they're, even though they're small flies, they're big enough that just with your naked eye, you can actually see their eye color. And most of them are red, as you'll notice. That's the wild type. A wild type doesn't have to be dominant, by the way, but it often is. And in this case, it is. But the other possibility in this case is white type eyes. That's not what's different. We're used to having two traits for a characteristic. But this one is different chromosomally. Remember, the theme of this chapter is what's happening at the chromosome level. And what's different about this is that this is an example of a gene that is sex-linked. Now, before I go on, let me say that there is a difference, even though they both use the word link, there is a big difference between linked genes and sex-linked genes. In fact, I didn't even really give you a definition directly of linked genes. I gave you a definition of unlinked genes, right, just a moment ago. But there wouldn't be the word unlinked unless there's also something called linked. Importantly, it doesn't make sense to talk about one gene as being linked or not. Because linked means two different genes are on the same chromosome. They don't have to have anything to do with each other. They just happen to be passengers on the same boat, the chromosome. Okay, so their two loci, wherever they are on the same chromosome. And it doesn't make sense, therefore, to talk about one gene being linked or not. You have to be talking about a pair of genes to determine whether those two particular genes are linked. And that's all it means. They're on the same chromosome. All right? A sex-linked gene, though, it does make sense to talk about a single gene as being sex-linked or not. That's one possibility, sex-linked. And what that phrase means by itself is that the locus for that gene is on one of the sex chromosomes. Now, think back to the human karyotype that we looked at, which was just an example of a karyotype. Any given sexual species, you can make a karyotype of. But for many species, including humans, there are two major categories of chromosomes. And the ones for us that are numbered 1 through 22 are all examples of what are called autosomes. The 23rd type of chromosomes in humans isn't given the number 23, even though it's the 23rd type. It's a different category. The 23rd kind is called a sex chromosome. Now, sex chromosomes get their name because in that species, they are involved in determining the sex of the offspring. But that's not the only thing they do. They are chromosomes. They're just called sex chromosomes because they're involved in sex determination. All right? Autosomes are not involved in sex determination. But there's another important difference about sex chromosomes between sex chromosomes and autosomes. Autosomes are truly homologous pairs. What I mean by truly homologous is that they are the same size as each other, the two number ones, for instance, the two number fives, all the way through 22 for humans. Those two homologs are the same size as each other. They have the same number of genes, the same types of genes, just not necessarily the same alleles. Not necessarily the same versions of those genes, right? But that's what makes them truly homologous. So for any autosomal gene, which is the other possibility besides a sex-linked gene, an autosomal gene is simply a gene that resides on any one of the autosomes. In other words, it's not on a sex chromosome. But for any autosomal gene, whatever it is, a diploid organism is going to have two of those, right? Two alleles, because each of the two homologs is going to have an allele for that gene. Sex chromosomes are not truly homologous because they're not, in at least some species, they're not the same size as each other. Almost certainly you've heard of X and Y chromosomes in humans. Those are the two sex chromosomes. They're the same type of chromosome because we have only one sex chromosome in humans. But there's two different sizes. And the X chromosome is bigger than the Y chromosome and therefore contains many more genes than the Y chromosome does. All right, now this is the most important difference with respect to what we're looking at here in this example. Because if you have a sex-linked gene, which simply means it's on a sex chromosome, then a diploid individual could have either one or two alleles for that gene. In humans, sex determination chromosomally is whether it's an individual's XX, two X chromosomes, or XY, one of each. Well, the X chromosome, being bigger, has more genes on it than the Y does. So there are some genes that are on the X chromosome only, and there's not a corresponding position on the Y chromosome. All right? Therefore, a female would have two alleles for that gene. It would be just like an autosomal gene, except it's on the sex chromosome. But since she's XX, both of her sex chromosomes are the same size. A male, on the other hand, an XY, would have just one allele on his only one X chromosome. The other one's a Y chromosome that doesn't have that gene at all, doesn't have that gene locus. You see the difference as far as spatial possibilities are concerned? Well, let's look at the next slide to look at cartoons of the chromosomes and make sense of this. So the particular fruit fly eye color gene that we're looking at here is not autosomal, it's sex-linked. It's on the sex chromosome, and specifically it's on the X chromosome, but not on the Y chromosome. They happen to use the same XY system that we do. Okay? Now this looks, when you look at this cross, it looks very similar to the monohybrid cross using flower color that we started with. But it's not the same. The reason it looks like it is because we are paying attention to exactly one characteristic, just like in a monohybrid cross. And it looks like a hybrid cross because one parent is different in its trait for that characteristic compared to the other parent, right? One's red-eyed and one's white-eyed. Well, it also looks like it's the same as that purple and white flower color because when you cross these two parents, every one of the F1s has the dominant phenotype, red eye, just like every one of the F1s in the pea plants were purple flowered. That's why I said it has the appearance of being the same kind of thing going on, but it's different. And that's why there's a bit of information in that top line that we didn't have before. What do we see on that top line, the pea generation, that we just didn't pay attention to at all before? Right. The symbols for the gender are here, or the sex. This is the female symbol, this is the male symbol. Okay? We didn't care about that for purple and white flower color because it did not at all matter. You could have the true breeding purple flower be the mother or the father. And it would all the numbers would be identical. Or the prediction numbers would be identical. Here, though, it matters. Okay, so by the way, it's even deceiving beyond F1, because when you then mate the F1s with each other to produce the F2, it still looks like it's just like the flower color one, right? Because you have 3/4 of the offspring in the F2 being dominant and one being recessive. But this is different because the 3-to-1 ratio for pea flower did not care about the sex of the individuals in the F2, right? It just says 3/4 of them, whether they're male or female, are going to be dominant and 1/4 of them are going to be recessive. Well, that's not what's happening here. When you make the F2s, 100% of the females, both of these are females, are going to be red-eyed, dominant. Half of the males are going to be red-eyed, and half of the males are going to be white-eyed. Okay? And that does not happen unless it's a sex-linked gene. Let's look at the bottom, which is just a repeat of everything we looked at in the top, only showing the chromosomes for clarity. So the sex chromosome, like I said, in fruit flies is the same for us. We use the same symbols. X and Y are the two possibilities. And it also works the same way with sex determination. So a female fruit fly is an XX. Notice that matches up with her sex symbol. She's XX. He is XY. That's what makes him male, the XY. But the eye color gene doesn't have anything to do with sex determination. It just happens to be on the sex chromosome. And it's on a part of the X chromosome that's bigger, remember, that doesn't have a corresponding part on the Y chromosome. So the gene, there is no allele on the Y version for him. She has two separate eye color alleles because she has two X chromosomes, and there's one on each. He, though, has only one eye-colored allele because he has only one X chromosome. Well, remember, we've been using the words homozygous and heterozygous all along. Those words only apply to individuals that have two alleles for the gene, which is true for autosomal genes, right? But this male it's not correct to call him homozygous or heterozygous. Right? Homozygous means both of your two alleles are the same as each other. Well, he doesn't have two, so that doesn't make sense. Heterozygous means the two alleles are different. He doesn't have two alleles. So he's not homozygous or heterozygous. We use a special word for males in sex-linked genes, and that is hemizygous. Hemi meaning half. Hemi, semi, and demi all mean half. If it's a species in which males are sex determined this way, which not all species are. So it's true for humans, it's true for fruit flies, it's true for a lot of animals, but no, not every species.
Would it be true for the owls then?
Yes. It's in birds it would be possible for a female to be hemizygous because she has one of each. And if it's a sex-linked trait, then yes, we would call her hemizygous. And he would be either homozygous dominant or heterozygous because even though it's a sex-linked trait, for whichever sex has two of the sex chromosomes, it really operates the same as an autosome. Okay, so those are the parents. Now when it's time to make their gametes, there still is only one possible gamete for this female, right? Because she is wild type, which is what the W stands for. By the way, this is yet another standard for genotypes. We're using W. I'm sorry, W doesn't stand for wild type. W here stands for white, which is the recessive. Usually we use an initial for the dominant. But the W here stands for white. Except if you put it as plus superscript, then instead of it being the white version, it's the red version, the wild type version. So she's double W plus. She's red, in other words. And therefore, it doesn't matter which one of those gets picked by meiosis. She can make only one kind of egg. But since we're talking about a sex-linked gene, that means it's carried by a sex chromosome, and the sex chromosome determines sex in addition to whatever that specific gene does phenotypically. So there's two things we need to keep track of: the chromosome type itself and the gene version, the allele. Well, she has only X chromosomes, and they're both carrying the same allele for color, so it doesn't matter which one gets picked. She can make only one kind of egg. He, on the other hand, is a male, so he has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, and therefore, just for that reason itself, he can make two different kinds of sperm. You can choose the X chromosome or the Y chromosome. It's not individual genes that move around, right? It's chromosomes. So that's why he has two different sperm here, because he has two different chromosomes that can be chosen. But if the X chromosome gets chosen for a sperm, it's carrying a white allele. If the Y chromosome gets chosen, it's not carrying any color allele. He's hemizygous. All right? Well, when you make this Punnett square, you're paying attention not only to the characteristic, but to the sex. Because the types of chromosomes coming from the parent determines the sex of the offspring. If you match up an X chromosome egg, and in this case, an egg would have to be an X chromosome, right? Because the egg's coming from the female. A female is XX, has to be an X. But anyway, you get an X together with an X sperm, you make an XX individual, which has to be female by definition. So that's why the female symbol is on this half of the Punnett square. You match up X with X. When you match up X and Y, you make a male. Okay, now that's just the gender itself. Now we can figure out what's happening eye color-wise. Well, this XX zygote, which represents all possible females, because it's the only way it can happen, is going to have a red allele from the mother and a white allele from the father. And this is just simple dominance now. Since red is dominant over white, this is going to be a wild-type, red-eyed female, and all the other females will also be in this F1 generation. On the other hand, all of the males will be the same as each other because there's only one way to make a male here. A male has to get his X chromosome from his mother because being XY means he has to get a Y, which only males have. He got that from his father. He has to get the X from his mother. So all males are going to have a red allele from his mother and no color allele from his father at all because there is no place for it on the Y chromosome. So all the males are also going to be red-eyed. This is why it looked like up here, this is just like the flower color, because all the F1s are red-eyed, but for a different reason. Right? All of the females are red, all the F1 females are red-eyed heterozygotes. All the red-eyed males of the F1 are red-eyed hemizygotes. That all make sense? Okay, well, the bottom I'll talk about next time because it'll probably take me more than a minute.